once more onto the breach, dear friend.
Yeah, let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. You weren't very enthusiastic with that.
It's because I'm so used to saying my name.
You know, I mean, so normally you say McClure rather than McClure.
It's trying the monotone.
Okay.
Just one.
Just once?
Just once. Jeff and Jake.
I don't think that's going to work on the radio. I think
people go to sleep.
Right. I think it's important on the radio to overemphasize your words and to be rather enthusiastic. This is my opinion. Now, I could be wrong. But we can't tell about these things. Well, you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach, and The Personal Wealth Coach, purely not by coincidence, is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado that does wealth management for people who need who would like to have a decent, consistent return in their portfolios or something like that. And registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, and we tell you that so that you'll know who to complain to if you don't like the radio show. Program.
You can't see
presentation. It's not really a program because we're not programmed. Well, maybe we are. There's the question of free will. Anyway, if you'd like to call in here and ask us some questions or make comments or something about the state of the economy, the market, the world situation, anything except sports, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
You are really behind the power curve today.
My computer is telling me it's going to restart in 5 minutes, and I'm trying to stop the countdown, and it's like...
Is it Microsoft?
It is Microsoft, and it's actually doing this because it was a setting that was put in there, and I could change the setting, but the countdown's already started. So this is like Star Trek.
Yes.
Self-destruct sequences going, and there's a countdown going, so I am busily trying to search for a way to stop it.
I can understand. You know, you were talking about Catbert.
Yes.
In Dilbert, by the way, there's Dogbert and there's Catbert. Dogbert is going to take over the world, but he's going to do it graciously. Catbert is the evil version of Dogbert. And Dogbert, I think, resides at Microsoft, which is why, by the way, I use a Mac. It may be going to take over the world at some point, but it's not being very successful, and it's nice about it. So, anyway, that's the way I work off of this thing. So, we have a caller on 773-1400, and caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Go ahead. Hi.
Yes, I was just calling to see what happened to Ed's show.
What happened to Ed's show?
Yeah.
Did something happen to it?
Yeah, it just... At 9:30, he was gone.
Oh.
There's some other stupid show on.
Well,
no, I was listening to the show playing when we walked in. It wasn't him?
No, it wasn't him.
Oh, well.
They had some farm show on, and then all of a sudden they had a rerun of him for the last 15 minutes.
Oh, well. Do you want the whole truth on that? How much truth do you want?
Can you handle the truth?
We used to have a guy who worked in here on weekends who was very consistent and really knew what he was doing. And he kept all the antiquated equipment in here pretty much all running together, more or less.
Mostly by talking to it gently.
Yes.
I don't know exactly what it was. There was magic involved somewhere.
And he was here for many years. And then one Saturday we came in and he was gone. And since then, there's been a new person in here every week. And they generally don't know what they're doing in this control capsule here.
Are you talking about a guy named Marshall?
Yeah.
Marshall was here, yes. And Marshall was consistent and, doggone it, Marshall was good.
What happened to Marshall?
He just suddenly wasn't here. I mean, have you ever worked for a corporation?
No, sir, I have not.
Okay, well, anyone who's ever worked for a corporation and this... Town Square Media is a corporation by whom we are not employed, by the way. Town Square Media is like any other corporation. There is an employee there one day, and the next day they're not there, and nobody will talk about it. And I think this has something to do with something somebody read in a in an apocalyptic science fiction magazine or something several years ago, and somebody said, ooh, let's just make people disappear. By the way, just for the record, Marshall counts really high on my list of heroes.
Yes.
He was excellent. I used to call Ed occasionally, and he would, you know, he was the call screener.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just excellent about doing what he did.
He was more than you know. He had another job besides this one, at least one other job, and he worked. He would work all night, and then he would come here and work all weekend.
Right.
And he was heroically raising a child at the same time on his own.
Right.
And how often do you find a young man in our society who is that heroic? I mean,
right.
he was working ridiculous hours, doing a fine job apparently everywhere he worked, working overtime and everything else to be responsible in his own life. And I just, like I said, and he did a really high quality job in here.
Right, and that's absolutely the truth. And what you just said, we don't have people in this country anymore that are willing to
Wait a minute. Marshall, to the best of my knowledge, is still in the country.
Right.
I think he left the country.
I mean, we're talking about somebody right now who is in this country who's doing that.
And I hate to tell you this, but I got people in my office who do that too.
There are a lot of the reason why it seems like there aren't that many people in the country that are doing that is because they're working instead of being out where you can see them.
Right. And very frankly, there are really high-quality young people in the country who are doing really high-quality work, and most of them are employed.
Right.
And so the ones that you run across in wherever you run across them probably don't fall into that category.
Right.
Yeah.
Because the ones that are really good are working.
I don't mean to take up a bunch of your time.
That's
You've
all right.
got a quality show, but it just seems like every time I listen to Ed, there's always some screw-up somewhere, and it just gets, you know, just disgusting, quite frankly.
It's one of those things, very frankly, let me tell you, that this, what you're talking about is the economy. You're talking about the fact that, and when we had the last show we actually did live, I think it was the second last show, anyway, we had Lynn Woolley on here, and he was talking about the decline of AM radio. The fact that AM radio, well, there's two issues that are going on here, and they're really significant in the economy.
Right.
One, AM radio has declined in popularity, mainly because of its competition from the internet. The second element that's significant here is the concentration of wealth, corporate wealth particularly, which results in the fact that there's only very, very few major owners of, like, maybe three or four at most companies that own over 90% of the AM radio stations in the United States.
Okay.
And this was, and if you, do you know Lynn Woolley? Do you listen to him?
I do occasionally.
Okay.
When we're down here working on our home. We actually live in Dallas. We come down here on the weekends.
Okay.
And we work on our new house down here. But I listen to WBAP in Dallas, and that station up there is flawless.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that station up there is a blowtorch.
And it is, because
it's in a major
metropolitan area. They have managed to maintain quality, and as a result, they can charge a lot for advertising.
That's correct.
Whereas what's happened with the smaller A, and this is to me the great irony. Lynn is a rabid conservative. That is the lowest level of descriptive adjective I think I can give to him. But he is terribly upset about the fact that the government relaxed its regulatory control of who can own AM stations. He thinks that the government should be far more, go back to the old regulatory control that mandates a great deal of diversity in AM stations so that they're owned by individuals and they don't give the license, they don't concentrate the licenses in a few corporations. You know, and it's one of those things where there's a certain amount of irony there. But that's a big trend in society. And what happens, of course, is as something like this declines, It can't be exported overseas, although I think sooner or later somebody's going to figure out how to do it.
Yeah. They export it over the internet.
Right. And we could wind up with KTM, for example, not even existing in a physical location here in this building where there's, I think, five other radio stations in this one tiny building.
Right. When we first started this program, you started it in 97. I joined you in 98. We were in a large building that was only this studio, this station. Mm-hmm. And we had...
It used to hold KPLE as well.
Well, that was years before. Yeah.
Right.
So we would sit in a, you know, basically you look at the old television shows that looked at radio studios. It was a big room, and it had windows on two sides where producers would sit with microphones that would talk to us as the phone calls would come in and say, this is so-and-so on the line, and only we could hear it, and it was very, very nice. We've gone backwards since then. There are more computers. The building was sold, and KTEM was put in a building with a lot of other stations, and it's because AM is going away. It's being completely replaced. Now, in major areas where there are the possibility of millions of people listening, we have, at one time, this station had 100,000 people listening to it at any given time.
Right.
And it's probably half that now. And it sounds like we're complaining about it, but the reality is that this is just technology. It happened to real estate in that the only way you used to be able to find a house to buy was to pick up a newspaper and start calling real estate agents. And now we go online. It's happened to music. It's happened to television. It's happened to every major industry. If it hasn't happened to the major industry yet, it's because it's about to.
Right.
Technology is just doing that.
Except oil drilling.
Well,
still takes a lot of people.
Well, even that, I've been doing a lot of very intensive research there. It does take a lot of people, but it takes less than half that it used to, and because you don't have to have as many places to drill from. You have one central location that's drilling out in lots of directions,
right.
And there's people sitting at a
yeah,
computer
right.
doing that. So that initial drill takes as much, but once you're in there doing that, it's a lot easier.
You're right. And actually what it is you have more people, you have fewer people working longer.
Yes.
But it's still, society is changing, and unfortunately...
We're fortunately.
You know, the way we get around this on this show is really simple. I run the board.
Yeah.
And we don't have a quote engineer who isn't an engineer,
and
but
that,
once
that's
was.
That's the reason why your show is impeccable every week.
Well, it's not. believe me. We have.
You know, as close as you can damn sure get.
Well, I'm going to tell you that this show sometimes gets pecked.
Yeah.
It isn't impeccable.
The quality show that you used to have was Sunday morning at 7 o'clock with Ben Barrick. And he just. Flew the coop.
He did. I didn't even know that Ben flew.
Yeah, he's not on anymore.
Well, you know, that's another thing. We had Lynn on here, and the issue is that Lynn is syndicated on a few AM stations.
Yeah, he's syndicated, but he can't really afford
right.
a large group of people. The advertising money has come down. There's a lot of ways of looking at this. Basically, if you look at consolidation, when consolidation is happening in any industry, it's generally right at the end of the industry. At the end of the end industry.
Yeah, like all these radio stations I told you that are in here, there's like five radio stations.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
maybe there's one, maybe two people other than us.
In this building.
And sometimes when we go out and look around, there's nobody else in the
right.
building but
the
us.
The computers are just running away.
Because the actual, if you go to any of these multitude of FM stations that are in this building with this one AM station, you'll find that... most of them have a little room like this one, and there's a control board with lots of little lights flashing and things move and lights and LEDs moving up and down, and nobody's in there. But if you tune to that station, you hear somebody talking.
Right.
And that's because the somebody is probably in Chicago or someplace.
You actually touched on a subject that unintentionally that we were planning on talking about. There's a lot of news out there right now about the concentration of wealth. And we're talking about the concentration of corporations right before the end of an industry. concentrations of wealth seem to be the big subject of the day. When economists get together, they say the people that are really wealthy are getting more wealthy, and the people that are really poor are getting more poor. And it's really easy to hear that and say only the rich are getting rich and everybody else is getting poor. But that's not what was just said.
No, that's a great song.
Oh, yeah, I think there's a... Is that country music?
It's an old song that my mother used to sing. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Right. Okay.
In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
See? Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
See, now, you actually have music on this station, too.
So. Yes, and it's...
I don't know, that's a bit of a stretch.
So, when I'm looking at the data, what I see is that the rich people are getting richer, the extreme rich.
Mm-hmm.
The poor people, extreme poor, are getting poorer. But there's fewer of both of those ends.
Well, now,
there are fewer really rich people than there were in 2008 by about half. There are fewer really poor people than there were in 2008 by about a quarter.
But the rich are richer and the poor are poorer.
Right.
Which means a song that was written in the 1930s.
It's still accurate because
right.
It's still the same situation. It's still the same. It's not like this has changed. And people talk about this trend line that was happening where there were more and more rich people. That the group of people that was making more than $1 million a year and then more than $10 million a year, that kept growing. And it did all the way up to the recession. The numbers, in pure numbers, of if we talk percentages, the group of people that were hurt the most in the recession were the ultra-rich. We went from 18,000 people or 18,000 tax returns that made more than $10 million a year to 7,000 people. So if you look at that as a percentage, you got like 30% of the people that were doing it are doing it anymore.
But Janet Yellen made a speech this week. She said, yes, what you just said was true.
Right.
But the rich people have recovered.
Yes. Well, we're not quite back up to where we were before recession as far as numbers go. And what I'm saying about the concentration, it means that the people in that concentration, while the income dropped in that group, if you look at it per person, the people that were still in that $10 million plus range were making more money than they had before the recession. It's just the people that left that group were making less money. So that's what we talk about. There's no way to talk about in a soundbite that's easy to understand this divergence in income. So it sounds like the middle class is suffering when the reality is that there are less poor people, but those poor people that there are less of are suffering more than they were before.
Well, now, wait a minute. I don't know if anyone has a suffer gauge.
We need to find a suffer gauge.
Because, for whatever it's worth, and the way
there is a happiness
gauge. My gauge is real simple.
What's that?
We've got all these reports that the economy is just fine, and that since Obama has taken over, everything has improved, and this and that. Well, everybody in this country is working part-time.
You are?
I mean,
are you working?
I'm self-employed. I'm a general contractor. Everybody that works for me is full-time.
Yep.
And all these other people, you know, are hiring half-time workers. That way they can get out of paying for insurance
right.
and all this other kind of stuff.
And by the way, the news...
It just boggles my mind what's going on in this country.
The news media, I don't know what... I don't pay a lot of attention to the popular news media. I do know what the economists are saying, including the magazine, The Economist, that Lynn doesn't like. And
He didn't say he didn't like it. He just said he didn't read it.
He didn't like it, but he's told me on several occasions he doesn't like that magazine. It's too liberal. But the fact is, The Economist continues to report what you just said is true, is that while we've got unemployment down to 5.9% or thereabouts right now.
Right, and that's because we have 9 million
right.
people that are not even looking for jobs anymore.
Well, there's some good reasons for that. That's a bit of a red herring. The issue is that those who are working, a lot of people who went back to work, who previously lost their jobs, are working multiple part-time jobs and making less than they did before the recession.
That's correct.
And they're working longer hours and they're making less money. By the way, as far as people who have stopped looking for jobs, a lot of that has gone away. The vast majority, and when I say vast majority, I'm talking about the really big chunk that falls into two areas of the people who've stopped looking for jobs. One is people who have retired and they're drawing Social Security. The boomers long forecast to have a massive retirement about now, and they are. And oddly enough, when people retire, they no longer go down and try to draw unemployment. I don't know why, but so they don't count as job hunters anymore, and a lot of them are not working. The other group is a bunch of, there's a really good size chunk of the population that worked because they basically were getting paid enough that they didn't have to do a lot, but they could make money, but they really didn't need to work. In other words, let me give you an example. A very large chunk of the not looking for work anymore people are women who are married, or oddly, in about half the cases, not married, who put off having children to work and develop reserves and get a house and do things like that. Well, during the recession, when they lost their jobs, they decided to have children and stay home and take care of their kids.
Let me address something completely different. Okay. It's something you mentioned there. You said people talking about since Obama was elected. Let's talk about the real red herring here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's go back to any economic collapse, any economic recovery. This is, anytime the economy has a shift, it takes a long time to shift. Presidents,
oh, that's correct.
Yeah,
that's
president, correct. Presidents have an impact on the economy, but it tends to be as long as decades later.
Yeah, it tends to come after they're in office.
They're no longer around by the time. You know, Obama didn't cause the recovery any more than Bush caused the collapse, any more than Clinton caused his surplus. He just happens mm-hmm. to be here at the right time. And in an election season, that's what people talk about.
Yeah,
and for good or ill.
Can you answer me one question here?
Well, we might. Depends on if we have the answer.
My question is real simple. We have all these people that work in all these coal states.
Mm-hmm.
And Barack Obama said you can go ahead and build all the coal plants you want, but by God, I'm going to tax the hell out of you. You know, and now
actually, wait, no, hang on just a second.
Off the bridge.
No, hang on just a second. I need to interrupt you because let me break something to you. Taxation comes from the House of Representatives.
That's correct. I understand that.
And the committees in the House of Representatives that determine whether or not coal plants are going to get taxed are dominated by conservative Republicans and have been for a long time. So blaming the president, who is probably a little bit left of center liberal, for something that right of center Republicans are doing in the House of Representatives is a bit
weird. Well, there's the EPA. I think that's what he's talking about. The EPA is an organization that is determined to save the ecology,
right?
Which is good. It's what it's supposed to be doing.
Right.
So
the environment,
But is it not true, if you will remember, when Barack Obama was running before he was elected,
mm-hmm.
he said that is when I become the president of this country, in essence is what he said, was that you will pay dearly for a coal plant. And coal plants basically supplied 75% of the energy that it takes to run this country mm. at a much cheaper rate, and it's even cleaner than it was 30 years ago.
Do you remember in high school when the city... Or the student.
A long time ago,
right. So go.
1965.
All right. sit back and think back of the student council elections and the president of the student body, before he was elected, said he was going to get rid of the lunch lines, because that's going to make him popular. Does the president of the student body have the ability of getting rid of lunch lines?
Oh, he does.
Well, I mean, he could.
He could go to the principal and say, give everybody study hall who stands in a lunch line.
Right. The reality is that people make promises when they're running for office that have no reality. And this is one of the biggest... The reason why the liberals are so upset with the current president, who is a liberal, is because he made a lot of promises that the president's office doesn't have the power to keep.
That's correct.
And let me... And again, I want to point something out here. Our coal plants... paying penalties for burning coal? And the answer is, I'm going to be very frank with you and say no. They're paying penalties if the stuff that comes out of the end of the pipe is toxic.
You're talking about the stacks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In other words, if poison comes out of there and drifts into the air, then they pay a penalty for that. If they clean it up, as you mentioned, and some have, they put scrubbers on the stacks, then they don't pay penalties.
Now, this is kind of another key here. If you look through a lens of politics at anything, you're going to see politics. If you're talking about the economy, if you're talking about the environment, if you're talking about global warming, if you're talking about Ebola, if you're looking through the lens of politics, which is really, really thick right now because there's elections going on, you're going to see a distorted view of the world. It's going to be based on popular opinion. Well, that's not where science is. Real science isn't popular opinion. It's data. It's, I have an idea, now I'm going to try to prove myself wrong. And if we're talking about the economy, it's the same thing. It isn't the president that causes a recession. It's the economy. It is people's, it has to do with tax rates, but it has to do with employment. It has to do with how many banks have been overextending in their loans. It has to do with lots and lots and lots of things. And it's really easy. Let me go the other direction. It's impossible to think of all of the complexities in the economy. It's impossible to hold all of that in your mind. So we as humans, which hopefully most of the people listening are humans, we try to make the definition of what's going on simple by saying Obama or Bush, or by saying this law did that, or because of some relief for some people getting loans, this caused the loan. It isn't that simple, and I wish it was. It's a lot easier for sound bites. It's a lot easier for people to understand if it's simple. But this is why they don't teach surgery in elementary school, because it's not simple. And the human body is a lot less complex than the 300-plus human bodies that make up our economy.
So if you're talking about simplicity here, why is it that every time a question is asked, the libs go to the talking points and everything is blamed on George Bush?
The same reason why conservatives go to Obama.
Wait a minute. Hang on just a second.
Why do they keep doing that?
For the same,
they just state what's actually happening, did happen, what it's going to take.
Hang on. I'm going to answer your question.
Okay.
For exactly the same reason that if you ask a conservative, why is this happening, Obama's name appears. Frankly, the president of the United States has next to no effect on the economy.
On the current economy. What's happening, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that's going to have an impact on the economy for a long time into the future.
But he didn't write it.
He didn't write it.
Congress did.
Congress did. The prescription healthcare benefit is going to have a massive impact on the economy over a long period of time. That's from Bush.
Well, it was his idea. And
right.
In both cases, the president had the idea, and they asked Congress to pass a bill, but Congress wrote the bill.
And the Congress at the time was the party of the president. So they wrote the bill according to the way that they thought the president might want it. So then it went forward.
They like the drug legislation that Bush pushed through.
Right. Which
he left.
Yeah.
Which is now affecting our economy.
Right. Which is the single largest social benefit
outside of Medicare. I'm sorry.
Actually, it's dollar wise projected to get bigger than Medicare at some point.
It's going to be huge.
But the point is, and he didn't raise any tax. Unlike Medicare, which was obviously passed under a liberal regime, Medicare included a tax to pay for it. Now, it hasn't quite made the grade, but it's still, there was a tax. Whereas when George W. and the Republicans were in office, this is a little to contrast the two, they passed the Drug Benefit Act, but did and lowered taxes.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to break this to you, but you have to pay for things when you pass them. And they found a loophole in the law that enabled them to give voters and people on Medicare the largest dollar benefit, arguably, in the history of the United States government without paying for it with any taxes.
Let's go to another thing real quick. Reagan is almost sainted on the right.
Let's get either Ronald Reagan or President Reagan. Let's not just say his name here.
Just Reagan?
Reagan's not good enough.
Okay, so Ronald Reagan.
President Reagan.
President Reagan.
Yes,
okay.
Let's like saint somebody, you know.
If you say Reagan to me, trust me, I know who Reagan is.
Okay.
Right, but we have to say this. It's kind of like if you're a follower of Islam, you don't just say Muhammad. You say Muhammad, bless his name, or something.
Whatever.
I happen to think Ronald Reagan deserves the pedestal that we put him on.
Okay. All right, he's an amazing man. He was one of the great presidents.
Yes, yes.
So don't get me wrong here.
I got you.
Without a doubt, the best in my lifetime.
All right. Also, during his administration, so don't miss the fact that I just said he was one of the great presidents
of
all time.
Yes, I got that. President Reagan was.
Right. During his administration, the size of the government grew at a faster rate than any other president in the last century and a half.
Yes.
And that's because he increased defense.
And
Jimmy Carter tore it all down, and it cost
that's not,
a fortune.
No. Hold on. Time out. That's an easy go-to. Yes, he did increase defense.
Well, it is an easy go-to, but it is a fact, and it is the truth,
right?
I think.
Yeah, well, it is part of the truth. Don't gloss the rest over. The entire government grew during that time period, and it didn't just have to do with government contractors. And then Clinton, who was also a pretty good president. I know that's hard to say after I just said that Reagan was one of the greats. Clinton was a pretty good president. If we look at the long-term impact on the economy in a good sense, NAFTA has done more for our economy, and that is measurable. People can look these numbers up. Jobs, growth, trade, all the good things that we look at was done because Clinton said do it. So if you look at any part of the economy through the lens of politics and say right wing is good, left wing is bad, or the reverse, then you're missing things. You have to step back a second because politics is really about the emotion of I'm right, you're wrong. If we don't stop for a minute...
No, that's not true. I'm right, you're wrong.
No, I'm right, you're wrong.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, see, that concept...
That's only if you're educated enough to know who the hell you're voting for.
That's true. If not, then it's just about, I like the names here, and it's better than writing Mickey Mouse. So there's some random factor in there, too. But the reality is here, if we really want the country to get better, we have to stop saying the libs always fall back to, or the conservatives always fall back to.
Mm-hmm. You're going to leave the always out.
Got to find the common ground and stop saying you guys always or we always, and start saying, well, that guy had a good idea. Why don't the conservatives pick that up? Obamacare is a great example of that. About 60% of that law was written under the Reagan folks. They took it from Nixon. So two conservatives
And it was put into effect
under a liberal group.
No. It was put into effect in the state of Massachusetts.
Right. Under Mitt Romney.
And basically they copied what Massachusetts had done into Obamacare, and all of a sudden it's evil.
Well, there are parts of it that are wrong. There were parts of the Romney plan that were wrong.
You got it.
If we say we must repeal Obamacare, then we're taking out the big chunk that was in there that was designed by the Republicans. And if the reality is that you cannot repeal it with the votes that are there, it would hurt too many people.
And you can't repeal it, period, at this point.
Right, okay. So we need common ground. That's what I'm saying. We need to find a place, not all about compromise, but about what's right for the country.
One other thing, too, when you look at Obamacare, we're actually looking back to a great president like John F. Kennedy. If you really think about this, some of the tales about Obamacare actually started back with Kennedy.
You're absolutely right. He was the first one to mention the idea.
Exactly.
Well, actually, I'm telling you know, something that's fascinating and ironic to me. I study history a lot, and I really do have some grasp of the dynamic of the American people. And what's really fascinating to me is the screams to abolish Obamacare, to repeal it. Because I'm going to tell you, if we repealed Obamacare, we'd have to replace it with something instantly, or the Democrats would dominate if, let's say, the Republicans take over, and let's just say they had enough votes to override a veto and they repeal Obamacare. That would guarantee, at the next election, a Democratic president, a Democratic House, and a Democratic Senate.
It would also probably guarantee a recession.
Yes, it would put us into a recession. It would take health insurance away from literally millions of people suddenly with no warning.
The insurance industry would lose a lot of money, and I don't mean that because they would.
Absolutely right.
But let me take this out.
What is our chances of not repealing Obama? Care, but to just go ahead and modify some of it.
But if you listen to the rhetoric from the right,
that's not even part of the conversation.
They should simply
be.
Say,
"I'm sure should be."
They say, "Repeal it."
And that's what upsets me about the right.
Let me take this a step further. I want to take you to the next level. If we were to repeal Obamacare within 60 days, you can write this down, within 60 days. We would have an extension of Medicare to cover the entire population and a tax.
We would go bankrupt.
No, and a tax that would cause your eyeballs to squiggle.
Oh, well, yeah, but if you didn't tax, we would go bankrupt.
Right.
But you're going to tax in order to keep the country afloat.
Right, yeah. And what would happen is all of a sudden everybody's health insurance bill would disappear.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they instead, you'd just be paying.
Single pay.
You'd just
it's
be single
payer.
Paying money to the government. And so repealing of Obamacare would move the system hard to the left. And yet it is the right-wingers, the conservatives, who are pushing to have Obamacare repealed. And the moment it's repealed, I will guarantee you, we will wind up with a truly socialist health care system almost immediately.
There aren't that many strategic planners on either side. The long-term strategic planners are either in private industry or something. Paul Ryan occasionally has some moments where I go, whoa, he's thinking ahead.
He will immediately disabuse you of that.
Then he turns around and messes it all up, and I go, oh, no, that was a mistake.
Bring all the troops home from everywhere and put walls up around our borders.
No, different. Yeah. That's different. That's Rand
right.
Paul.
But
a different Paul.
Oh, okay.
And Paul Ryan is the...
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm thinking of Rand Paul. Yeah.
Rand Paul...
Well,
no,
these Paul guys, you got to watch.
There's a lot of Pauls around. Anyway, the concept of deep, long-term planning is something that is fairly strong in the startup community of corporations. If you look at what Elon Musk's doing, if you look at what's going on over at Google, the research that's going forward, the technology that's being developed, even if you look at pharmaceutical plants, these places that are building, you know, people don't really like to talk about big pharma, but
General Electric. They're
saving lives. General Electric.
Long-term
planning. And then you get to politics, and it's really about winning this particular pig fight.
Right. Well, look. Let me just ask you one last question.
Okay, we got to do some commercials, so make it quick.
Okay, the amount of money that we're spending on defense right now,
right,
is absurd. It's because we're doing everything wrong. We took all these people out of Iraq. Now we're going to spend 10 times more to go ahead and get Iraq back where it needs to be, even if we can do that.
I don't think we're going to spend 10 times more.
Well, why was it? I know that Obama has to, you know, appease his constituency, but why did he take all these damn troops out of Iraq?
Because
why couldn't he have left a contingency force in there?
Because he made a severe error.
Two things.
There's no question about
two
that.
Two things. The former prime minister
on that statement.
Hang on.
Hold on. The former prime minister of Iraq would not sign a status of forces agreement.
We could have done. That guy was a puppet.
No, he was definitely not a puppet.
Listen to yourself a second. Wait,
Hang on. Time out.
Listen to yourself a second. If you said, you just said that the United States appointed a puppet, what's the point of having a democracy if we control it? That was one of the really amazing things about the George W. Bush presidency, is he gave the control of the countries that we conquered to the countries. He didn't keep it. It's not puppetry.
Which is
it's
why Hamas
real.
Is in power in Palestine.
Right. He believes in democracy, and that's what we got out of it.
Yes, sir. You're absolutely right.
No puppets.
What happened was the man that won the democracy and became the president, so-called the president, he's the one that just turned face. Because of whether it be religious or whatever over there, and that's the reason why.
Yeah, but I'm going to say that you said a minute ago he was a puppet.
Turned upside down.
You said a minute ago he was a puppet. He's not a puppet.
Yeah, that's okay. That's the key. And that's part, you know, Obama followed the Bush plan in Iraq for withdrawal almost to the T. He used Secretary Gates, the defense minister. He's the guy that George W. Bush appointed, was reappointed by Obama. So Obama has made some good decisions, and he was kind of stuck because the Iraqis said, no, we don't want you here anymore. And when a country says we don't want you here and we've done everything we can to put them in a place where they have the ability to do it, it's kind of like the teenager that's telling the father, no, I don't want your information. Now they're begging. Now they're coming back and saying, come back, come back.
Right.
It's too late now.
You're trying to tell me that the Japanese and the Germans say we don't want you here after World War II.
They didn't have a choice. We didn't give them that choice. Let me throw. I'm going to put, which is probably the last word in here because we do have to do commercials.
Yes, sir. I understand.
The Rumsfeld and the Bush administration made a horrific error based on ideology, and the ideological error was the democracy would always produce the right response. They believed in democracy. It's practically a religion to the Bush administration. However, if you'll notice, democracy gave us Hamas in Palestine. It gave us the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And it gave us some blithering idiots in both Afghanistan and in Iraq.
Well, I'm going to give that to you. You're absolutely right.
And the fact is that the model that Marshall set up, Marshall and Eisenhower,
right,
in Germany and Japan, is we would basically have a military dictatorship and control the initial several elections. And here's the key. Whenever we go into some place, if we want to stabilize the future, American troops have to remain on the ground in a significant number for a generation, 40 years.
Correct.
And we got to remember this when we start talking about going to war.
And this is George W. Bush said he didn't want to do nation building. He didn't want to be there for 40 years. He didn't want to commit the United States to that. But if we don't do that, then we have the Islamic State.
Well, we got to go. Thanks for your call. Hey, good conversation.
Yeah, my name is Vince, and I enjoy your show a lot, and keep up the good work.
Thanks, Vince, for the call. And have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you, buddy.
And we are the Personal Wealth Coach, and because of the fact this is... Wait a minute. Oh, yes, there it is. Maybe that's... I'm hoping we have some commercials that we're supposed to play at this point. It looks like... I don't know.
We'll give it a shot.
I'm going to try to play some commercials. We'll see how this works out. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach. We'll be back on the other side of these commercials. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Apparently, advertisers don't like our show anymore.
Advertisement
and one PSA, and that's the whole thing for the hour. Got to talk to the sales staff or
something. See what's going on here.
Okay, anyway, we do have about 8 minutes left in the show. Telephone number's in here.
This hour.
Yeah, we'll have another hour, Lord willing. The future is always uncertain. We could have a massive meteorite strike right here any
could
moment.
Be. Any second.
Yes. 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise?
1-866-597-1400. Some minor things happened in the market this year.
No, nothing. But the number of millionaires, you're talking about a measure of wealth at the upper end. I don't know.
We're using different numbers. I'm not talking about the number of millionaires. I'm talking about tax returns, people that have made more than $10 million in a year.
Well, I'm
adjusted gross income.
I'm going to just use this as a marker. The number of millionaires in the United States back in 1996, in 2007, we got up to 9.2 million millionaires.
Nice.
Which, by the way, is a lot of money. And we dropped down to 6.7
millionaires. 6.7 million, not 6.7.
Millionaires.
Yes.
A million million's a really big number.
Right.
In 2008. However, we are now up to 9.63 million millionaires. So recovery is in place. I don't know what people are complaining about.
That's recovered faster than the growth in the population. There are more millionaires today than before the recession.
And in any other, there are more millionaires in the United States. Of course, million inflation, a million is just not what it used to be.
No.
But still, there, I would say that if a person has a net worth of $1 million, they're reasonably well off.
Yeah. And the future is not what it used to be either.
No, that's not. But we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question. If you guys could explain how interest rates work, how they are affected by the price of treasury bonds, you know, what makes them go up and down. Can you just kind of give me a lesson on interest rates?
Yes, sure.
And I'm going to hang up.
Unfortunately,
thank you very much for your show. Enjoy it.
Unfortunately, we understand that to some degree, which is scary.
All right, I'm going to give a really, really basic example. I'm going to use two non-existent banks.
There's a lot of them around.
Right. These banks are not only non-existent, they never existed.
How about Killeen Savings and Loan?
You can use
that
right.
One. Yeah, I remember that. That's a non-existent
First
bank.
National Bank, Killeen. Well,
no, that one exists.
Oh, okay.
How about Second National Bank?
There we go. All right.
There probably is one somewhere.
Most people believe that they've never owned a bond. Most people have bank accounts. Therefore, most people were wrong about believing that they'd never owned a bond. When you loan money to a bank, you own a bond. On the bank's balance sheets, they have your deposits listed as a liability. They have to pay you interest, just like you have to pay interest to a credit card. At this point, they're not paying very much interest.
In some cases, they're not paying any interest.
Right. When they look at their balance sheets and what they can do, they're allowed to loan out the money that you have loaned them. They're only allowed to loan out some part of it. If another bank says, we don't have enough money sitting here to make loans, we're not going to make any profit. So they raise the interest that they're paying people on deposits. Then you're probably going to leave your bank and go to the other bank because they're paying a higher interest, which causes the first bank, the one that had the low interest rate, their deposits drop. They're not able to make loans. They make less money. That is a microcosm of what happens in the bond market. If you own a bond, say it's $10,000, and it's paying you 1%, and it's from a really good place, and that same really good place says nobody's loaning us money because the interest rates that we're trying to get people to take are too low, we got to raise the interest rate or nobody's going to loan us the money. So they raise the interest rate to 2%. Same place that you've got a bond that says 1% on it. So this new bond comes out, people buy it, they loan the money to the corporation, they're getting 2%. Well, you look at your bond and you go, I spent the same amount of money to get 1% as those people spent to get 2%. I'm going to get rid of this bond and I'm going to buy one of those bonds. Well, what you discover is that the cost, the payment that you get for your bond is less. Particularly if you've got a long time before you get your money back, a long time before they have to pay you back, the maturity date. Because nobody wants 1%. They want 2%. 2% is available, so you have to lower your price to a point where the person buying it gets 2% or close to it on the amount of money they pay. So when interest rates go up, people with existing bonds, their values go down.
And by the way, you asked the question, how do 10-year treasury bonds affect the interest rate? They really don't. They're affected by the interest rate. It's like, how does your fever affect your virus infection? Well, actually, it does have an effect, but not much.
Yeah, the fever is part of the reaction to the virus. The virus is the cause.
There's another way of looking at this that I use. It's exactly the same thing he just said. It's just I explained it a little differently. And that is that if you purchase a bond, and I'm going to use some radically different numbers here that are
just
absurd.
Let's confuse everyone with absurdity.
That's okay. Let's say interest rates were at 10%.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it wasn't.
And then they were at 5% at one point. So let's say you purchased a bond, and if today somebody offered a 10-year treasury bond or a treasury bond at 5%, even 30-year.
Wow. That'd be really nice.
People would just gobble it up. So now what you've got in a bond, by the way, in the market, a bond is $1,000. I realize there's bonds for more than that, but it's a standard denomination.
Standard, $1,000.
So you've paid $1,000 for a bond that's paying you $50 a year.
I like this $50.
If interest rates go to 10%, and they did at one point, on long-term bonds, then somebody who goes into the open market and wants $50 only has to buy half a bond. In other words, they're getting $100 for putting $1,000 into Treasury bonds.
Right.
Your bond's only paying $50. Now, this isn't exactly right, but it's pretty close if it's early in a 30-year bond.
Yeah, you have to measure the length of maturity and lots of other things.
But it's pretty close here. And in fact, it does actually work out this way sometimes. If you went with your $1,000 bond, it says $1,000 right on the front of the piece of paper, if you actually had the piece of paper, and you went to the market and said, I want to sell this, you would get $500 for it. And the reason is the new bonds being minted will pay somebody $100 a year. So if somebody buys your $1,000 bond for $500, they get $100. They could buy two of them and get $100 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So their $1,000 produces $100 a year. A new $1,000 invested produces $100 a year. So rising interest rates cause the price of bonds to fall. Falling interest rates cause the price of bonds to rise. And it's strictly the law of supply and demand. And the issue is that when the Fed, for example, is buying bonds, they effectively pump interest rates up and they make the economy work a little better because people are willing to lend money if they can get interest for it. But if they can't get interest for it, they're not willing to lend money. And that's bond 101 in a nutshell.
When
right
they're buying bonds, they're lowering interest rates.
When they're buying bonds, they're lowering interest rates. When they're selling bonds, they're raising interest rates.
And when you lower interest rates, for those that qualify for a loan, it costs less money to get that money out and use it to buy a house. And if anybody looks at their own mortgage right now and says, 10 years ago I was paying 7%, and they look at what they're paying now, it's kind of nice. Anyway, we're almost out of time.
Unless you're a mortgage company.
And until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to contact us off the air, there's voicemail at 947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour.